When you hear Orlando, Florida, what's the first image that pops to mind? Is it a sunny beach? Or is it Disneyland? Whether back in 1976, the era that I'm going to bring you back to this season, or currently, most people think of Orlando, Florida as a vacation destination. But like any vacation destination, there are people who were born there and live there, or people who moved there and put down roots. Linda Kerr's family was the latter. Linda was a 15-year-old blonde-haired, blue-eyed little girl, and she lived with her family on Dolly Street in Orlando, a few blocks from Curry Ford Road near Bass Lake. Back then, the area was small neighborhoods dappled between sections of orange groves, which are long gone now. Linda was born in Washington, D.C., where her mother, according to her obituary, worked for the Pentagon. Linda attended Boone High School, and she had four brothers and two sisters. She was a middle child. A couple of her siblings had already left home, but 18-year-old Keith and her two younger siblings still lived there in the small Florida home on the corner of Dolly and Grant in what I would describe as a benign, middle-class residential neighborhood. Her boyfriend, Michael Stewart, lived about a block down and a half mile south on Aaron Road. And this is where it is alleged by one or two of her siblings that Linda was on her way around 4 in the afternoon on the last time that she was ever seen. In the short narrative on page 1 of the report was the information given to law enforcement by Linda's father, Andrew Kerr, when he called police around 1:20 a.m. on February 19, 1976. An officer was dispatched, and he arrived at the Kerr home just 6 minutes later. Mr. Kerr told them his daughter was almost always with her boyfriend Michael, either at his house or theirs, until about 9 p.m. every evening. Her brother Keith told police that he last saw his sister at 4 o'clock when she left the house to walk to Michael's house. It's also noted in the report that Keith told them she was not depressed when he saw her that day. Based on the only other thing in that first report, taken in the wee hours of the morning, more than 9 hours after she was allegedly last seen, is that her father told them that a male named Mark Lindsay, who his daughter had known several years earlier, had shown up the Sunday evening prior to talk to his daughter, and that would have been 3 or 4 days earlier. Later that day, investigators would speak to Gina Parks, Linda's 16-year-old friend, who she had been with earlier in the day, not long before she was last seen. Based on the time in and out on the report, an officer with Youth Aid had spoken with Gina for just short of an hour. But the only thing he wrote down on the report, in that summary, about that visit was that Gina told him about an older white male that worked down at the Crystal Corner, which was a convenience store about 6 blocks from Linda's house, who had been convicted of indecent exposure 2 years earlier. Apparently, this individual had asked Gina if they had found the missing girl. So I guess a guy who has flashed some high school students, asking about where one of them was, sparked enough of a question in the officers' minds to visit the next day. And at the Crystal Corner store, the officer learned that the clerk had seen Linda around 3 in the afternoon on Tuesday, but that was the day before she went missing. However, he said Linda's boyfriend Michael had been in the store on that Wednesday, looking for Linda. So now it kind of makes sense why he would be asking about the missing girl, because at least one person, her boyfriend, had already come into the store looking for her, and that was well before Linda's father had called police to make a missing persons report in the wee hours of the morning. The next item on the report says that two detectives intercepted 19-year-old Mark Lindsay while he was hitchhiking along Fern Creek Road. Now, this is the guy that Linda's dad mentioned as having visited Linda that previous Sunday. Mark Lindsay told police that he had been looking at a Playboy magazine on Sunday and he came across a picture that looked like Linda, so he decided to go to her house. Now, having two autistic sons myself, I can appreciate the direct, honest response, but I'm not so sure that kind of directness hits the same for everyone. The report notes that Mark said he had known Linda since November of 1975. And that's only a few months, which doesn't quite match up with what her father had told them, that she had known him some years back. But Mark could not come up with any reason why Linda would run away. He said that she got along with everyone. When he was asked by the detectives if he could think of anyone Who might want to harm Linda? He rattled off a few names of a few guys that he said had expressed an interest in having sex with her. He did mention a 22-year-old guy named Robin that was married with kids and had just gotten out of prison. He thought maybe he knew Linda. But Mark Lindsay could not really come up with anything substantial. He was just tossing out names like people do when investigators come knocking, asking about a missing girl. It was all very vague and unhelpful. And at the end of that summary of his interview, police made a note that Mark had been involved in a car accident at the age of 5, and it appeared to them that he was, quote, somewhat mentally disturbed. However, it was clear that there wasn't anything of value gleaned from that interview, and nor does it appear that police found anything he said to be concerning. After this, they swung over to boyfriend Michael's house and interviewed him. He was also a high school teen, and he said that Linda was not the type to run away from home because she didn't have any problems. He told them she did not hitchhike or associate with strangers, and she did not do drugs. He couldn't come up with a reason that she might have disappeared either. Then they asked him about anyone in the neighborhood who might be of questionable character, and then the officers drove him around, and he pointed out two houses. In one, he said, lived a middle-aged man who he'd heard was showing porn films to kids in the neighborhood. The investigators jotted down the cars and tag numbers, and one of the vehicles parked in the driveway was registered to a Robert Russell Olin. He was 44 at the time, and where he lived on Dolly was about 0.3 miles straight south from the Kerr house. This house would have probably been on Linda's walking route to get to her boyfriend's house on Aaron Street. She would walk right past it. Russell's 71-year-old mother, Winnie Jessen, owned the home at the time. A quick search tells me that Russell Olin was an offender from a very young age. He did prison time at 20 for grand theft. He also had a 1979 charge for selling heroin, which would have been a couple years after Linda went missing. And I didn't find anything on his record that involved any sort of sexual crimes. Police swung back by the Kerr home and spoke with her father again, but he insisted that he could not offer any explanation as to why his daughter would run away. Now I want to pause here to say that that was not the truth. That was a lie. Because if Mr. Kerr believed his daughter Linda had run away, he knew, at that moment, exactly why she would have done so. The report says that they called Mr. Kerr back the following day, now 3 days since she's last been seen, and he told them he hadn't been home at the time, but his son Butch said he had talked to an unknown red-haired girl that the assistant principal at Boone High School, Mr. Bonatus, had spoke to, who said that Linda knew someone who had just gotten out of prison. Police left a message with the assistant principal, and then they called her boyfriend Mike to ask if he had heard anything about that, and he said yes. He had heard those same rumors, but he had no idea who the source was or what that information was about. The assistant principal got back with him pretty quickly, and he said he didn't know the source either. He was also listening to rumors. He did recall, though, that back in 74, 2 years earlier, a few Boone High School students had been involved, along with some students from another local high school, in a prostitution-type situation. He also said that a female student had told him that she had seen Linda and her boyfriend on Wednesday night in the neighborhood around her house. It's clear from the reports that there was a lot of rumors and speculation flying around on campus, so it makes sense that the investigators reached back out to Mr. Kerr and asked him for the names of Linda's girlfriends. Police began tracking those girls down one by one. Diane lived just down the street, and she had no idea why Linda would run away. But she did say that Linda had minor verbal disagreements with her father. When they talked to Cheryl, she said that she had heard some of the same rumors that the assistant principal and others had heard. And she told police that she had learned that Linda had called her friend Gina Parks on Wednesday night, the night of her disappearance, to ask Gina for a ride to her boyfriend's house. She said Gina wasn't feeling good at the time, so she couldn't give Linda that ride. The next afternoon, they spoke with Linda's father again to see if he had come up with any more information. He told them that her boyfriend Mike had gotten some information from someone in the neighborhood that on the night before, someone had observed a big black car with the back window broken out, parked on the dirt portion of their street with bright lights on. This unknown person supposedly observed someone in this car, a white female, that appeared to be Linda from, quote, a profile standpoint, and the driver was described as having black hair and a mustache. Mr. Kerr told them that the description of this driver would fit a boy named Paul, who was also 15, like Linda. And now understand, this alleged sighting would have been after Linda went missing. A few hours later, around 5:20 on the 22nd, and we're now 4 days since Linda's been seen, her father called the detectives back and told them that he had learned about that prostitution incident that involved Boone High School students, and he gave them the name of the detectives at the Orlando Police Department who had been on that case, as well as a couple of names of students who he was told had been involved in some capacity, none of which, by the way, were his daughter Linda. At about 9:30 that night, investigators went back and met with Michael, the boyfriend, and Linda's brother, Butch, who had both apparently been doing some of their own investigating. They said they had information that someone named Chris had information that Linda was being kept in the neighborhood somewhere against her will. They also said that a girl named Diane Veglia saw Linda, or a girl that looked like her, near the area of Bass Lake, at the south end of their street earlier that afternoon. Police did track down the source of one of the rumors. A guy named Chris said Linda's friend Terry had heard that Linda was being held in a house 3 blocks from where she was picked up by some unknown person that Terry referred to as an idiot. Terry allegedly had gotten her information from a boy named Ken, who was attending university in Melbourne, and she had overheard it at Nichols Alley, right after Linda went missing. Nichols Alley, as described in a 1975 Orlando Sentinel article, was a club hoping to appeal to 18 to 30-year-olds. Flash, volume, vibrations, cheap drinks, old movies, games, and dancing. A red-carpeted boogie hall designed for the be seen and meet someone crowd, with eye-level tabletops, a $50,000 flashing plexiglass dance floor, billed as the largest in Florida, and a live drummer to add beat to the vibes. On the 23rd, now 5 days since Linda Kerr was last seen, investigators went back and did a more thorough interview of Michael. He told them that he had known Linda for about 10 months, and they had been dating for about 8 of those. He told them that they had sex on 2 or 3 occasions, the last incident having occurred about 3 months earlier. He told them that he had not used any form of birth control, and he also shared that Linda had what he called a bleeding problem at times. It's at this point that they finally get down to working on a detailed timeline as well. Michael said that he had taken Linda to school that day, on the 18th, and when school let out, he took her home. That day happened to be early release. The last bell rang at 12:37 p.m., and he and Linda left the school minutes later, around 12:40. At 12:55, he dropped Linda off at the Kerr house, and he got home around 1 o'clock, because, again, he only lived less than a mile away. Then Michael and a buddy named Mike Dietrich went job hunting from about 1:20 to about 3:15, and he called Linda as soon as he got home. And it was at that time that they made plans to go to a place called Hotfoot's that night. It was a popular teen hangout, a game room in Sanford, Florida, about a half hour away. She said that she was going to come over to his house around 5:30 after her mom came home with a car, but she never showed up, and she never called back. And at about 10 p.m., he called her house, asking to speak with her, and he was told that she wasn't there, although it doesn't say who told him that. Mike said that around 3 a.m., Linda's father called his house looking for her. Investigators asked Mike about previous boyfriends, and the report said that he, quote, finally admitted, as if they had been looking for that answer the whole time, that Linda had, quote, used to be somewhat wild, used to hitchhike, and had smoked pot and drank alcohol. He then told police that Linda was very scared of her father because, quote, at times, Mr. Kerr has fondled Linda's breasts. Mike said that he had known about it for months, since around November of the previous year. They asked him a couple more questions, and then their next stop was to speak to Linda's oldest brother, Butch, who confirmed that he knew, from his own mother, that his father was fondling Linda and that his mom had once threatened his dad with divorce if he continued. I was able to confirm, from an announcement in the Orlando Sentinel, dated 1970, so 6 years earlier, that Mrs. Kerr, Linda's mother, had filed for divorce, but she apparently didn't follow through with it. After that conversation with Linda's oldest brother, investigators went to speak with her oldest sister, who was 18 at the time and she lived in her own apartment. She told them that she had been subject to the same sexual abuse since the age of 12 and she had just moved out 6 months earlier to get away from it. She said that the last time she was aware of that Linda had been fondled by her father was 2 months earlier. She told investigators that her mother had tried to get their father to undergo medical treatment, but he refused. On the next day, the 24th, 6 days after Linda went missing, police went to Boone High School and they interviewed some of Linda's friends. One said that Linda had confided in her that her father was molesting her, and he had molested one of Linda's friends when she spent the night with her. This witness told investigators that Linda had told her on multiple occasions that she hated her father at times. Next, the investigator spoke to the friend who was alleged to have been molested at the Kerr home when she spent the night, and she verified that Mr. Kerr had fondled her while she was asleep on their couch, and at that time she gave the sheriff's department a 2-page sworn statement about the incident. Now, a newspaper article released this same day indicates that the Orange County Sheriff's Department had gotten a search party together to do a search of South Orange County, saying that they were concentrating on orange groves and wooded areas. 9 deputies and a helicopter descended on the areas near her home with no luck. There was mention in this article by a private investigator working for the family of that prostitution solicitation trial from the previous year and their concern that retribution was somehow involved. However, the police report indicated that Linda was not one of the people who testified in that case. Investigators did not believe that there were any facts to indicate that that event had anything to do with Linda Kerr going missing. They went back to interview Mr. Kerr, hoping to get some more information. Although what stands out to me most is there is not a single indication that they asked him about the sexual abuse of his daughters at all. What he did tell them at this occasion was that on the night of Linda's disappearance, his wife had called him at work at 12:30 because he was not at home at his usual time. He alleged that he was working late. After the father's interview, police proceeded to interview some of Linda's siblings. However, it doesn't say whether these siblings were interviewed alone or in the presence of one or both of their parents. Linda's brother Keith, who was 18 at the time, said he saw Linda at the house at 4 o'clock watching TV, and the next time that he was aware of the time was 10 minutes to 5 when a friend came over knocking on the door and he realized that nobody else was in the house. 10-year-old Karen said that she had watched TV with Linda that day and her sister left the house without saying anything to anyone. Karen said that she and her brother Butch left the house a few minutes after her, and as they passed the dirt portion of Dolly Avenue, she alleged that they saw Linda walking down the road. They slowed down the car, she said, and Linda told them that she was going to her boyfriend Mike's house, but she did not ask for a ride. I will note that there is no indication in this police report that anyone told police that story on the day that she was reported missing. Police finally talked to Linda's mother, and I presume this interview was done alone, without other family members present, given the content of that interview. Norma Jean Kerr told police that on the day Linda disappeared, she and her daughter Debbie had come home from lunch, and Linda and Mike, her boyfriend, were outside the house in Mike's car talking. And it sounds like this was when Mike dropped Linda off, because she said her daughter followed her inside, and she didn't indicate that there were any problems at the time, or that she was unhappy. Linda's mom said that in the past, she had pressed her daughter about whether she and her boyfriend were having sex, and Linda denied it, saying that Mike respected her too much. Mrs. Kerr said that she didn't believe Linda did any drugs, and that if her daughter was able to, she would call her, even if she did so without telling her where she was. At this point, the investigator asked Linda's mom directly about what they had been told by multiple people regarding Mr. Kerr molesting his daughter. The report says, quote, Mrs. Kerr freely admitted knowledge, saying that Linda had told her 3 or 4 months ago that Mr. Kerr was fondling her breasts. Mrs. Kerr said that she did not take any action, nor did she confront Mr. Kerr with any of the allegations, because she had done so in the past and it was not effective. She told investigators that her husband entered Linda's room practically every night to turn off the radio that Linda would have playing. When investigators asked Linda's mother if she ever tried to protect her daughter, to go into the bedroom, or even stand at the doorway when her husband went in there, Mrs. Kerr said, quote, I can't stay up every night. I have to get my sleep. And then she said, I don't know how long he's in there, when they asked her about the length of time that he might stay in his daughter's room. That night, after they spoke to the family, police had surveillance on the Kerr home. And around 1 a.m., a patrolman spotted a late 60s red and white Pontiac convertible parked outside the Kerr residence. And the patrolman sees what appears to be a male dressed in all dark clothing, including a dark overcoat, walk between the two vehicles that were parked outside the Kerr residence toward the garage. The patrolman, obviously trying to be inconspicuous, passed the house and turned around when he was able to, and when he went past the second time, he saw that the subject in dark clothing was leaving in the Pontiac, and Mr. Kerr was standing at the now closed garage door. The patrolman followed the Pontiac to an apartment on Hansel Avenue, one street south of the Camelot Apartments, which were about 4.5 miles away. There is no other mention of this incident in the report, although in going through the list of witness names and addresses, Linda's brother Butch lived at 5537 Hansel Avenue, which matches the description of being one street south of those apartments. So it sounds like this individual in dark that left in the red and white Pontiac was Linda's brother Butch. When the patrolman ran the tag number to the car he had been driving, though, it came up to a 71 Ford, which was decidedly not the vehicle that it was currently on. And the patrolman noted that the apartment this vehicle went to, in addition to the apartment beside it, had been rumored to be trafficking in marijuana or narcotics. The next day, on the 25th, a whole week now since Linda Kerr went missing, police spoke with boyfriend Mike again, and he confirmed that Linda called him around 3:15 and they were planning to go to Hotfoot's. He added that Linda had told him at the time that she wanted to take her mother's car when she got home and then go to a girlfriend's house and then after that come pick him up at 5:30. And he waited, but she never came, and he never heard from her again. In this interview, Mike discussed an incident the previous year when he and Linda had gone to a Uriah Heep concert, and afterward they went to a house that his father owned that was vacant, and they spent the night. He denied that they had had sex, saying that they had both been drunk and they smoked pot. Mike told police after that incident, Linda was put on restriction for a month, and he lost the use of his dad's car for 3 days. But he said that there had been no problems with either of them since then. It was in this conversation, though, that he said to investigators that he was realizing that he had been putting a lot of pressure on Linda, demanding to know where she was at all times, and that, coupled with the problem of her father molesting her, quote, practically daily, and compounded by the fact that her mother did not take any action to address that situation, all of that made Mike think that Linda probably had run away. Maybe she wasn't abducted, like he and her friends had been thinking. He said that Linda had talked about running away before, but he thought if she had run away, her friend Gina would know about it, and she probably wouldn't even tell him if she knew where Linda was. That summary ends with this line.
Although foul play no longer seems to be a possibility, this case is put on normal investigative status.
That assessment troubles me as I review this file today, almost 50 years later, because I cannot fathom any scenario today where an investigator would look at the course this initial investigation took and they would hear the statements of these witnesses about Linda being sexually abused by her father and come to any conclusion that even slightly resembled foul play no longer seems to be a possibility. Because what we know statistically about girls who go missing, girls who we learn are being molested by a family member, is that there absolutely is a possibility that could lead to murder. But in 1976, it appears that the Orange County Sheriff's investigators were leaning into the idea that Linda could have run away because of the sexual abuse, but they weren't even considering the possibility that she could have been dead because of it, particularly since two of her own siblings and her own mother and her friends all knew it was happening. This was not a well-kept secret. This was, in fact, the elephant in every room of the Kerr home. On the 26th, now 8 days since Linda was last seen, the report reads,
"As of this date, the canvas of the area in which Linda Kerr may have traveled the day of her disappearance has proved negative in as far as anyone hearing or seeing any disturbance or seeing Linda being picked up by anyone."
And in fact, there was no evidence that anyone saw Linda walking anywhere except her siblings. Police finally got to speak with Gina Parks, and I'm not sure what took so long for them to do a long interview with her, because she was one of the last people to spend time with Linda, and she spent a considerable amount of time with her on the day she disappeared. Investigators spoke with her at Boone High School in the presence of the assistant principal, and Gina was able to help with the timeline as well. She said that Wednesday she got home from school around 12:50, and Linda called her at 1 o'clock, asking Gina to come pick her up. Now, this would have been just minutes after her boyfriend Mike dropped her off at home after school. Linda had not been home more than 5 minutes. Gina said she got to the Kerr residence about 1:15. She picked Linda up, and they went back to Gina's house. They were joined by friends Siobhan Olson, a girl named Delora, and a boy named Gary. And the five of them watched TV, and they hung out, wandering around the grounds of Gina's house, which were on Bass Lake. Around 2:30, Linda and Delora and Siobhan took Gina's car up to the store for cigarettes. They got back about 10 minutes later at 2:50. Around 3 o'clock, Linda left Gina's house with Siobhan and Delora. Linda walked from Gina's house, which is about a 13-minute walk, because Gina lived just a few blocks south of the Kerr residence. And Siobhan lived on Compton Street, which was just one street over from Gina and one street over from Mike, the boyfriend, on the other side. The timing is such that she would have called Mike right around 3:15, as soon as she got home from Gina's. Gina said that Linda called her back around 3:30 and asked her to come back and pick her up again and take her to Mike's house. So we know Linda made it home from Gina's, again wasn't there that long, and called her back to come get her again. It's very clear that from the moment Linda got home that day, she was making plans to get away from the house, and she spent as much time as she could away. But Gina didn't come back and get her that last time she called. She said she wasn't feeling well. The report goes on to say, quote,
"Estimates by Mr. Kerr indicate that he said he left the house at 3:40 and Linda was there."
However, the report also says that Linda's brother Butch said that he arrived home at 3:45 and he did not see Linda there. That is a pretty tight timeline, suggesting that Linda just up and disappeared in a 5-minute window. And what's missing in that report is any notation by police that Butch said that he got into a car and left after Linda with his younger sister and encountered Linda walking to Mike's house. The only statement in the report that that's attributed to is Linda's 10-year-old sister, no one else. Gina told investigators that while Linda was at her house on the 18th, they were talking alone in her bedroom, and Gina told Linda that she'd gotten into an argument with her older brother, and she had said something like, "I wish I could run away, but I don't have any place to go, and I don't have any money." And Gina said Linda responded something like, "She'd go to Candy Williams' house and stay there for a few days." Gina told police at this time that Linda had, quote, "considerable difficulty with her father." Linda had said to her, "One day, me and my mother are going to pack up and go away." Gina said that Linda had also told her, "I wish my mother would divorce him." According to Gina, this was Linda's dream, that her mother would divorce her father and she would be free of him once and for all. Gina then gave police a physical description of what Linda had been wearing that day when she was at her house. Linda had pierced, long dangling earrings on, a gold band with diamonds on her right hand from her mom, and a diamond promise ring on her left hand from her boyfriend Mike. She was wearing brown high-waisted pants with a safety pin on the zipper, a blue and white scarf, and a short-sleeved, low-cut white blouse with a cloud design. Gina also told police that she had been to the Kerr residence and had gone into Linda's room and found that Linda's purses and sandals were all still at the house, and so was her money, which would mean that Linda Kerr had left that day barefooted. When investigators asked Gina point blank what would cause Linda to run away, if she was indeed a runaway, Gina said it would be the problems with her father. She said another reason might be if she got pregnant. She had once heard Linda say, "I don't know what I would do if I got pregnant." But investigators reminded her that Gina had told them Linda had asked her for a tampon on the day that she disappeared. They were hoping to understand that contradiction. Gina clarified something that Linda's boyfriend had already told them, that Linda Kerr had difficulties with bleeding that was not associated with her period. Gina told police that she and Linda had made plans to go to New Smyrna Beach that Sunday, which would have been the weekend after she went missing, which does not sound like someone who's preparing to run away without her shoes and her purse and her money. Gina said hypothetically, if Linda called her mom and told her that she was all right, Mrs. Kerr might not tell Mr. Kerr due to her own fear of her husband, along with her inability to keep Linda safe from his nightly attentions. The dilemma, Gina said, was that Linda strongly wished that her mom would divorce her father, an act which Gina said Mrs. Kerr was either unable or unwilling to do because of her fear of her husband. The police then asked how reliable information given to them by Linda's little sister Karen would be, and Gina told them Linda didn't get along with her younger sister, and she was the last person that Linda would go to for help. She did say that while her little sister might lie to others, she would definitely tell her father the truth. She did tell them at the end of this interview that she thought Linda was probably a runaway, and her boyfriend Mike thought the same thing. Gina believed that Linda would be home soon. Police also checked Candy's house to no avail. Linda was not there and had not been there. The leads in this case were scattershot, mostly rumor that evolved into tips that had to be tracked down. Kids had heard a house had been staked out, and that evolved into Linda staying in some abandoned mansion or insane asylum in South Conway. There were two local girls who looked a lot like Linda as well. One was named Rhonda and the other named Anne, who it appears both had been mistaken for Linda in the days after she'd gone missing. There were a few pages noting how police had sussed all of that out, but that was yet another line of tips that went nowhere. On February 28, 1976, 10 days after Linda was last seen, her father received a series of telephone calls telling him that his daughter was being held for ransom. He reported it immediately and had gotten specific directions for payment of the ransom. The calls had come from an unknown white female and an unknown white male who told Mr. Kerr the money was to be paid in Marion County outside a small town called Fellowship. A call was traced as having come from a payphone at the Aloha Apartments in Orlando, Florida. There were two payphones in the complex, and when another call came into the Kerr residence, deputies that had been dispatched to the location watched a white female make a call from the phone booth at the rear of the complex. A female officer drove behind the woman making the call and heard her say words to the effect of money and making her way home. The Kerr household received multiple calls until finally law enforcement listened to the recordings and verified the voice was the person that the female cop had heard as she had driven by the phone booth. Police eventually picked up Carl and Judy Thomas, and they brought them in for questioning. After police played the recording of Judy making a call, she said, "I thought it would be a good way to get some money. I've worked hard all my life." Judy and Carl were arrested. Carl's statement, one he dictated but refused to sign, said this.
"The date is February 28, 1976. My name is Carl Thomas, and I am the husband of Judy Thomas. We reside at the Aloha Apartments, and I am presently at the Orange County Sheriff's Department building on West 33rd Street. Today, my wife read a newspaper account of the girl, Linda Kerr, still being missing from her home. She came to me with an idea as to making some easy money, which we wanted to put toward a home. She suggested that we call the Kerr family and make them think that we had Linda and demand a $20,000 ransom for her return. We could have the family take the money to an area near Ocala, a small town of Fellowship, an area known to us and near the area where my wife's grandmother resides. My wife made several phone calls after writing out what she wanted to say, and then tearing the notes up after the calls and flushing them down the toilet. Early this afternoon, while at Mr. Donut on the South Trail, my wife convinced me to make one telephone call to the Kerr family in order to impress on them that we meant business and the family had better do what they were told to do. I made the call, spoke quickly, and hung up. We then went into Mr. Donut and had donuts with the children. At no time have we ever seen Linda Kerr, nor do we know of her whereabouts. We do not know any members of this family. We do not have anyone in the area where the money was to be taken. We were planning on calling my wife's grandmother and having her come pick us up, take us to her house, and let us use her car to pick up the money, or else we would all hitchhike up and my wife and I would go pick up the money.
An article in the Orlando Sentinel dated February 28th, 10 days after she went missing, said that deputies had ruled out foul play in the February disappearance of a 15-year-old Boone High School student, and they had discontinued search parties. A department spokesperson said that it had been determined that there was no active criminal element involved in the disappearance of Linda Kerr. That's truly unfortunate, and it's unclear the extent to which that announcement may have depressed tips and information coming in. About a year later, in March of 1977, Norma Kerr, Linda's mom, got a call from a white male who stated,
"If you drop the charges against the Thomases, you'll get Linda back."
Mrs. Kerr said there was background noise and she believed the call had come from the jail. In an article the next day on the 29th that discusses the extortion attempt, police indicated again that they had called off the search because they believed that Linda had run away from home. Mr. Kerr is quoted as saying,
"I can't get the detectives to believe something has happened to my daughter. They still think she's a runaway."
In a March 11th article that year, Mr. Kerr said he believed that she had been abducted. Months later, in October of 76, about 8 months, in fact, after she went missing, investigators said that they still had not given up on finding Linda alive. They felt she left home on her own, and that is very likely because they knew she had been actively being molested. And obviously that is not something that they could share with the public, but it seems the basis upon which they determined she was a runaway. 7 years later, the Orlando Sentinel did a story about how Linda Kerr might be alive. Investigators had closed the case, they said, several years earlier, but the story alleged that what wasn't disclosed at the time, but had recently come to light, was that, quote, Linda Kerr had been seen dancing in a topless bar in Jacksonville a few months after her disappearance. Allegedly, someone had seen her in a bar that was frequented by members of the Outlaws motorcycle gang. And for my longtime listeners, you've heard me mention that particular biker gang on multiple occasions, because it's something that tends to pop up when police run out of leads and start grasping at straws. And I'm not being hyperbolic, I have literally seen it dozens of times. At the time, Mr. Kerr told reporters,
"They don't know any more now about Linda's disappearance than they did 7 years ago. We were told by investigators soon after she disappeared that she had moved to Miami and got married and didn't want to get in touch with us. That's the last we heard from investigators about her disappearance. If they knew she was in Miami, they could have just told her to call us and tell us that she was all right. They wouldn't even do that."
Linda's father said he didn't believe the woman seen at the topless bar was his daughter, and there is no evidence that either of these were viable leads. Just the type of tips you almost always see in the missing person cases of females specifically, which should tell you something. However, those tips in this case came to light when Linda's case was reopened after her brother Keith was charged with murdering his sister-in-law Carol Kerr, who was married to their brother Ken. Now, obviously that's compelling information that one of Linda's siblings, who was 18 at the time that she had gone missing, had murdered someone. And he was convicted, and I will tell you all about that in the next episode. But the details of that homicide sure do bring up some startling concerns about another of the men that Linda Kerr was living with when she went missing. Stay tuned.